This is the 2011 West Coast School of the Prophets. The theme for this weekend is the Day of Yahweh Draweth Nigh with our brother Carl Perry from Salisbury in Adelaide, Australia. This is actually the summary for session number 3, which was a workshop on the last days.
Okay, we thought we'd just take the next half hour just to recapitulate on what we've done. The presentations were very good, but we just need to just fine up some of the finer details on these prophecies just to make sure we're all okay. Now, Daniel 11. Let's look at Daniel 11 first. Come in. Right, we okay?
Yeah.
The thing about Daniel 11 is you're coming in at verse 40, which is a bit unfair to give you the end of the chapter because contexts are significant. So let's move back to the beginning of the chapter and let's try and work out really what these powers are, King of the North, King of the South, that reappear in the latter days. So let's come back to verse 2, Daniel 11 verse 2 to 4. Let's start there with Seth. Go that way, one verse each.
Daniel 11:32.
Yep.
And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet 3 kings in Persia, and the 4th shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia.
And a mighty king shall stand up, that shall rule with great dominion, and do according to his will.
And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken, and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others beside those.
And the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him, and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion.
Okay, let's stop there. This sets the time frame for the beginning of Daniel 11. And we have in verse 2 the emergence of 3 Persian kings and a 4th Persian king who would attack the realm of Greece. Does anyone know who that 4th Persian king was?
Alexander the Great.
No, the 4th Persian king.
Xerxes.
And it was Xerxes who was the one that took the battle into Greece. Battle of Marathon, remember that battle there in Greece? And he inflicted some severe wounds upon the Greek people. And the Greek people never forgot that. A number of years later, verse 3, a mighty king shall stand. Jimmy?
That's
Alexander the Great. So if you've got your margins, or you've got your notes, let's mark in there, next to verse 3, a mighty king, that's Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great. The Greeks never forgot that incursion, and they kept that in their mind for a number of years, and then BC 300 or so, Alexander the Great began to emerge. Son of Philip of Macedon. Now in verse 4, when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven. Not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion, which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others beside those. So Alexander's kingdom was divided into how many pieces?
4.
Does anyone know the name of the 4 generals?
I have Cambyses, Darius the First.
Verse 4, Alexander's 4 generals, Lysimachus, Cassander, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. Got that? Lysimachus, Cassander, Ptolemy, and Seleucid. And those 4 generals divided the empire between them. If we look at a map, this is what happened. Ptolemy took Egypt. Seleucus took all this region through here. And the other two, Lysimachus and Cassander, divided Turkey and Greece between them. None of those generals had any family connection with Alexander. How does that fulfill that verse of scripture?
Not his posterity.
None shall be of his posterity. Now, isn't that interesting? None of his descendants took control of this kingdom. So think of the providence of God. Not only making sure that Alexander dies, but making sure that he's got no heir to the throne and that the kingdom itself is divided into four. When it first split, there was five, actually, until finally they sorted themselves out and ended to be those four. Okay. Now, before we go any further, where else in Daniel do we see the description of the fourfold division of Alexander's empire? There's two quotes. Yeah, and what's the one before that? Daniel 7. Let's come to Daniel 7 first, get the easy one out of the way. Where in Daniel 7 does it talk about the Greek Empire being divided into four?
Verse 6.
Behold, a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl, the beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. So there it is, the fourfold division of the Greek Empire. Now, Tony mentioned Daniel 8, so let's come to Daniel 8 as well, because here it is as well. Which verse, Tony?
Verse 22.
Now, Daniel 8, verse... Yeah, before them.
Well, it's verse 22, but I think it's before that as well.
Yep. Verse 8. Okay. Nathan, could you do that for us, please? Daniel 8, verse 8. There it is again, the fourfold division of the Greek Empire. So it occurs in Daniel 7, Daniel 8, and Daniel 11. So we're in good company seeing the same repetition of ideas through the chapter. Now, let's stay in Daniel 8, and let's read the interpretation. Let's read from verse 20 to verse 23. So let's continue on afterwards. Brett, if you can go through there, one verse each, Daniel chapter 8, from verse 20 to 23.
The ram which thou sawest, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia.
Keep going.
The rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn is that between his eyes is the first king.
As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of the nation, but not with its power.
And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding, dark sentences, shall stand up.
Okay, we'll read one more verse. Yes.
And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And each shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper in practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people.
Okay, now we need this prophecy to understand Daniel 11. Verse 21, who is the horn of the goat?
Alexander
the Great. Let's write that in, shall we? Next to verse 21, the great horn, which is the first king of Greece, Alexander the Great.
It's the same as the notable horn from verse 5.
Yes, it is. It's the notable horn of verse 5. So verse 21, that great horn is Alexander the Great. Let's get that in our margins. Verse 22 is the fourfold division of the Greek Empire. So we're back to this map again, the fourfold. Now, this is the transition process. So we've got a pencil here, I think. So you want a pencil? Yep. Yep. Okay, Alexander the Great, notable horn. Now, here comes the critical transition I want you to understand. Verse 23, in the latter time of their kingdom, who is the their kingdom?
Four generals.
The four generals. Excellent. Let's write that in there, shall we? Their kingdom is the kingdom of the four generals. So what Daniel is saying is that whilst Alexander's empire is going to be divided into four, that eventually will come to an end. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when this territory by the four generals starts to dissolve and starts to be taken over, in verse 23, when the transgressors have come to a full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. What power took over the Greek Empire? Rome. So next to king of fierce countenance, I'd like you to write in there, Rome. Rome is the king of fierce countenance. Now, where in the Bible does that expression fierce countenance come from? Way back in the Old Testament, in the first five books, fierce countenance. Let's come to Deuteronomy 28. Deuteronomy 28. The expression occurs. And this locks in the interpretation for Rome. Where in Deuteronomy 28 does fierce countenance appear? Verse 50. Let's read for context. Verse 49 to 51. So let's start from the back there. Okay. Thanks, Nathaniel. One verse each, Deuteronomy 28, starting at verse 49 through to 51.
Yahweh shall bring a nation against thee from far, from the end of the earth, as swift as the eagle flew, a nation of whose tongue thou shalt not understand.
A nation of fierce countenance, which shall not regard the person of the old, nor show favor to the young.
51.
And he shall eat the fruit of thy cattle and the fruit of thy land until thou be destroyed, which also shall not leave thee either corn, wine, or oil, or the increase of thy kine, or flocks of thy sheep, until we have destroyed thee, until he hath destroyed thee.
What nation, in verse 49, which came from the end of the earth, as far as Israel is concerned, iron, has the standard of the eagle, and destroyed the Jewish people? Answer?
Rome.
So if you haven't got the margin, next to verse 49, that nation there is Rome. And how is it described in verse 50? A nation of fierce countenance. Now, if you have a marginal reference, you'll see there that in the margin is Daniel 8, verse 23. So next to that expression, fierce countenance, write Daniel 8, verse 23. That's the link which cements the interpretation to Daniel, that the king of fierce countenance in Daniel 8:23 is the Roman power. Any questions? Does that make sense? Okay, so it's a magnificent tie-in of scripture. Okay?
Is the expression in verse 49 where it says, a nation whose tongue thou shalt not understand, is that equivalent to this king with dark sayings? Is that what Daniel says?
No, it's just saying that Latin is completely different to Hebrew. That's what that verse is saying. Israel had no concept of Latin. The dark sentences is a different power and a different utterance.
Okay. A different meaning in Daniel?
Sorry?
So when Daniel says, is this dark speeches?
Yeah, that's a different power altogether. Yep, different power altogether. Okay, everyone have that? A nation of fierce countenance. Let's come back to Daniel 8, verse 23. So the sequence of the power shift is Alexander the Great, then his four generals, and then finally that's taken over by Rome. Let's come back to Daniel 8, verse 23. When he stands up, in verse 24, we find he's a dominating power. Okay, our next reader, please. Daniel 8, verse 24.
And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper in practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy places.
Who do you think the mighty and holy people are he destroys?
Israel.
Israel. When did Rome destroy Israel?
AD
70. So let's write that in there, shall we? Next to verse 24, the destruction of the Jewish state, AD 70. And this is why Jesus Christ knew that the Jewish state would be destroyed. This is one of the quotations. Because verse 24 says that he would destroy the mighty and holy people. That word destroy, straight out of Deuteronomy 28. Straight out of there. He'll destroy this people. All right, everyone happy so far?
Carl, can I ask you a question about the verse 23 where it says, and in the latter time of their kingdom,
yes,
when the transgressors are come to the full?
Right.
What do you think that's referring to?
Okay. We need to go back to the verses before that. In verse 9, out of one of them should come forth a little horn. The little horn is the king of fierce countenance. That's Rome. Okay? Which waxed exceeding great towards south, towards the east, toward the pleasant land. It waxed great even to the host of heaven. It cast down some of the host of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself against the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, it practiced and prospered. So those verses describe the destruction of the temple by the Romans. Whose transgression caused the destruction of the temple? The Jewish people. And that's why Jesus Christ said, fill ye up the measure of your fathers. Okay? So, if you want to make a note about that, in verse 23, the transgressors are the Jewish transgressors. They are the ones who crucified the Son of God. They are the ones that, in their iniquity, caused the destruction of the Jewish state. In actual fact, the drama of Daniel 8 is this, is that Rome, in verse 11, magnified itself against the prince of the host. That's Jesus Christ. Rome assisted in the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. How the chapter ends is that the Roman power is going to actually meet Christ again. But this time, Christ will be the winner. Let's go to verse 25. This Roman power that has destroyed the Jewish people, destroyed the Jewish state. Let's read verse 25. Our next reader, please.
And through his policy, also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand. He shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand.
Okay. Broken without hand. Where have you heard that before?
Nebuchadnezzar's image.
Exactly. Does the margin give us a hint? Daniel 2, verse 34. Let's write that in there, shall we? Daniel 2, verse... You know, this is the connection of the prophecies. The prince of princes is the stone power. The prince of princes is Jesus Christ. So we can write that in our margin. The prince of princes is Jesus Christ. He's the stone power that will break them without hand. Now, what verse 25 is saying is that as Rome develops, as Rome conquers Israel and destroys the Jewish people, in verse 25, through his policy he shall cause craft to prosper. Now that word craft is used in Jeremiah of religious priestcraft. Now I haven't got my wide margin Bible with me because it's too heavy to carry here, and I haven't got the marginal reference. Does anyone have the marginal reference in relation to that word?
Jeremiah, I think
9, 4-7. Right, Jeremiah 9 does ring a bell. It's used of the craft of priests.
Craft or deceit?
Yeah, craft, well, it's deceit. The word is used of craft and deceit, yes. But there's a quotation in Jeremiah 9 that uses it. 5, Jeremiah 5, you say?
Jeremiah 9, verse 5.
Jeremiah 9, can you read that for us, please, Jason?
And they will deceive everyone, his neighbor, and will not speak the truth. They have taught their tongue to speak lies and lead themselves to commit iniquity. Verse 6, the habitation is in the midst of deceit. Through deceit they refuse to know me, say.
Right, and that word deceit is that word craft. Okay? And that deceit is used in Jeremiah 9, verse 5 and 6 of religious deceit. So this military power, this Roman power, this pagan power that destroyed the Jewish people would subsequently encourage religious deceit. And Daniel 8 verse 25 says that the Roman power will one day meet Jesus Christ. And this time, instead of crucifying Christ, Christ will crucify Rome. That's the drama of Daniel 8. Rome crucified Messiah. There'll be another contest and Messiah will win. Okay, that's the drama of Daniel 8. But the point is that this king of fierce countenance is the Roman power. Now, with all of that background, any questions or comments on that before we move on? Everyone happy with that? Okay, this is the movement of the nations, Greece and Rome, and we've got a bit more information about this Roman power, this king of fierce countenance. Deuteronomy 28 confirms the fact it's a Roman iron power. Okay, let's go to Daniel 11. Now, in Daniel 11 and verse 4, we're back to the division of the Greek Empire. We're back to the division of the four generals. But Daniel 11 is only really interested in two of those four powers. And they're styled the King of the North and the King of the South. There we are, verse 5, the King of the South. Verse 9, the King of the South. Can anyone find the King of the North there?
Verse 6,
the King of the North. And verse, sorry?
8,
yes, it's there. So let's think about this. Here's Israel in the middle. South, North. As far as Daniel 11 is concerned, we are not interested in Lysimachus and Cassander's territories. We're only interested in Ptolemy in the south and Seleucus in the north. Now, here is the golden rule of Daniel 11. The king of the south equals a foreign power in occupation of Egypt. Why do I say foreign power? Because the Ptolemies were Greeks and they dominated Egypt. The king of the north is a foreign power in occupation of Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Iran, and it actually went across to Afghanistan. Part of Turkey. 15% of Turkey, if you like. That's just a little add-on. Learn that rule. The king of the south is a foreign power in occupation of Egypt. The king of the north is a foreign power in occupation of that northern area, which is Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Iran, and Afghanistan. Because that's the territories of the king of the north, the king of the south. Okay. What Daniel 11 describes is this constant conflict between north and south, with poor Israel as the meat in the sandwich. In fact, the details of these invasions is so accurate that some commentators said, "Ah, oh, look, it had to be written after the event. It had to be written after the event. It's just so accurate." We know, of course, it was written before the events. All right? We all caught up? Everyone happy with that? Now, all of a sudden, in Daniel 11 and verse 36... Our next reader, please. Daniel 11 and verse 36.
Daniel 11, verse 36. And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. For that is determined shall be done.
All of a sudden, in verse 36, we are introduced to a third king. Who is this third king? Oh, sorry, I thought you had an expected look on your face. Who is that third king? He's not the king of the north, he's not king of the south, he's a king. Exactly. Daniel 8:23, he is the king of fierce countenance. He is the Roman power. And that's the key to Daniel chapter 11 so far. A third power has now emerged into the arena. And that's exactly what Daniel 8 said. In the latter days of these kings shall the king of fierce countenance stand up. And here he is. Just before that verse, we have actually a reference to the Maccabees. We're not going to go into that this evening. This king of fierce countenance, which is in Daniel 8, verse 23, re-emerges in Daniel 11, verse 36. Okay? And he does exactly what Daniel 8 says. Let's read this. He shall exalt himself, he shall magnify himself above every god, he shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. What does that verse mean? He shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. This king will be around until the return of Jesus Christ. That's exactly what Daniel 8 said. Daniel 8 said that this king would stand against the prince of princes and be destroyed. This king is going to prosper until the indignation be accomplished. The Roman power will continue on the scene until it's destroyed by Christ.
What does that mean until the wrath has been accomplished?
Sorry, the...
What does that mean when it says until the wrath has been accomplished?
Okay, the anger of God will be accomplished against that power.
You mean when their iniquities are filled up? And then God's wrath?
Yes. Yes, correct. Correct. Jimmy?
I may be jumping ahead, but does that mean that this king ends up being Russia and is...
No. Jumping ahead. It's not the case. Let's work through it, shall we? Okay, we're all happy so far. Verse 36 has now introduced Rome into the equation. So verse 36, we can write in there Rome. Daniel 8, verse 23. That's the king, okay? That's the link. Now... the verses 37, 38, 39 describe the influence of Rome. In verse 37, he shall not regard the God of his fathers. That's interesting. Pagan Rome comes on the scene, and all of a sudden, pagan Rome changes religion. When did they change religion? In the days of
Constantine,
AD 312. So in AD 312, the whole pagan empire did not regard the God of their fathers. The gods of their fathers were pagan gods. So in AD 312, they became so-called Christians. Let's mark that in, shall we? Not regard the God of his fathers. They changed religion, AD 312, to Catholicism. Okay? They changed religion, AD 312, to Catholicism. He shall not regard the God of his fathers. And in that religious system, they won't desire women. How does that fit in? The Catholic Church teaches celibacy. The desire of women. That's where Paul got that in Timothy. Remember that in the latter days, come to pass, forbidding to marry? That's where Paul got this from. Okay. So we're talking about events in the Roman Empire, of a pagan Roman Empire changing into a Catholic Empire. In verse 38, He shall honour a God of forces. Now, I'm not going to describe all of that. It's a bit more detailed, but it's more information about how the Roman system supported the religion of the day. Now, we come to verse 40. The king of the south, the king of the north, disappeared from history. When Rome entered the arena, that map changed, and all of this was Rome. Rome dominated the whole region. The king of the north, king of the south, disappeared. But verse 40 says that those two powers re-emerge. See that? Verse 40. At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him. Now, this is where the exposition of Daniel 11 just missed out. Because there are not two powers in verse 40, there are three powers. Let me describe them for you. The king of the north, a foreign power in occupation of Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. In addition to that, a foreign power in occupation of Egypt. And this is where the missing jigsaw puzzle came in. Him. There are three powers. Who is the him of verse 40? It is the king of verse 36. Okay? Because we're in the context of this king. He shall do this, he shall do this, he shall do this, and the king of the north shall come against him, and the king of the south shall come against him. So the him of verse 36 is this third power. It is the king of fierce countenance. It is the power in occupation of that part of the Roman Empire. Let's pause there. Any questions?
No, I don't really understand what you're saying. So you're saying the king of the north and the king of the south both push at him?
Verse 40 says this. The first is a pushing by the king of the south.
Oh, okay.
Against who?
Him. See what says that? It says, at the time of the end shall the king of the south... It doesn't say push at the king of the north. It doesn't say that. It says push at him. And the him in the context of Daniel 11 is the he is the king of verse 36. And the he of verse 36 is that power which occupies the eastern part of the Roman Empire. Turkey. Okay, let's just pause there. See a few blank looks. Yep.
So it's the same effect. He's pushing against him, but then the king of the north pushes against
Let's just deal with the first bit first. We'll take each section bit by bit. What the prophecy is expecting is that a foreign power in occupation of Egypt is going to push at this power here, the eastern part of the Roman Empire.
Okay.
At the time the king of the south is pushing, there was no king of the north. How was that fulfilled? In 1882, Britain got control of Egypt. In 1914, in First World War, there was in fact a push of this foreign power in Egypt, England, pushing against the Turkish him. It pushed against the Turks so successfully, it pushed the Turks right back here to Turkey. And in so doing, liberated Jerusalem from the Turks. Anyone know what date Jerusalem was liberated from the Turks?
1917.
Anyone know who the general was, the British general?
Allenby.
General Allenby. Does anyone know who were the horsemen? The Anzac horsemen. Yay. It was the Australian and New Zealand light horse that assisted the British in pushing the Turks out. We have a place in prophecy.
You know, I had read somewhere that the contribution that New Zealand, it didn't say Australia, but I suppose it's yes. All together, that the contribution that New Zealand made to World War II was just as significant or more significant than any other nation's in comparison to its size.
Size, yes, that's right. Yep. Yep. He can sleep well tonight. Okay, so
I think that what helped me was when you said because you know we're going through this thing, Rome. But in our minds we're thinking West, that's Rome,
yep.
Right? But then we have to remember that it was, you know, you're talking about when we jump to this, the verse 40, talking about the eastern part of Rome.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, I probably didn't emphasize enough. This king of fierce countenance, this Roman power, ended up militarily ruling from Istanbul. So the eastern part of the empire was this king of fierce countenance. Yep, that's probably just a puzzle piece I missed out. So that's why we're talking here. The him is this Byzantium, this eastern military part of the Roman Empire. In the days of World War I, Turkey actually had the King of the North territory. Turkey was all through here. There was no King of the North. It was just purely Britain and Egypt pushing against the Turk and forcing the Turk back out here. For those who know Revelation 16, it's the drying up of the Euphrates. Okay? It's the contraction of the Turkish Empire. And it allows not only the re-establishment of the Jewish state, but also those Arab countries as well. Okay. So, It's not king of the north against king of the south. It's king of the south against him. First phase of the operation. The second phase of the operation is what? In Daniel 11, verse 40. What comes next? The king of the south shall
come against him like a whirlwind.
Right, now it didn't say push at him. It said come against him. It's a different military activity. Now, what's our golden rule? The king of the north is what? A foreign power in occupation of Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. That happens to be the Ezekiel 38 nations of Persia in Ezekiel 38. So what we therefore expect to see, it hasn't happened yet, is we expect to see a foreign power dominating Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, and Afghanistan perhaps, and when it actually achieves that domination, it will come against him. That is future. That is the Russian invasion of Turkey, but it will only do so when it has these countries under its heel. It can't become the king of the north until it takes those countries. When it has an influence in those countries, it could be economic, it could be military, but it actually controls those nations, then it becomes the king of the north, and then it can take Turkey. That is future. Questions, comments?
So that foreign power, the king of the north, that's Russia?
That's Russia. Okay. Yep, that's Russia. A foreign power in occupation of that territory is Russia. Why? Because whoever did the talk, who did the talk on this, made the links between Ezekiel 38, who did that? Ezekiel 38 and Daniel 11? Was that you, Jimmy? Yes. Yeah, all of those links are classic links. The events of Ezekiel 38 and the events of Daniel 11, verse 40 onwards, are paralleled. So you put two and two together, the foreign power that occupies the king of the north is Russia. It's Rosh. Yep.
It's interesting because now it looks like the U.S. is involved in those countries.
Exactly. So what has to happen? U.S. is out. Sorry, guys. All that expenditure, the U.S. will be out of Iraq. Russia is already making overtures for its oil revenues. Okay, but sadly, wasted time, wasted lives. They will be out. Jimmy.
Just to clarify in my head, because I'm a little slow, I just want to go over it one more time.
Yes.
Verbalizing it.
Yep.
So what we're saying is the king of the south pushing at him has already happened.
Correct.
The king of the north becoming the king of the north, Russia becoming the king of the north, that's the future.
Correct.
We have both past and future.
Correct.
In verse 4.
We're slap bang in the middle of that verse. Where that semicolon is, that's where we are.
Okay.
Jimmy.
Just a comment, I didn't know. You had said that once Rome came in the picture, the king of the south were gone, and they reappear in verse 40. And I got a little note, obviously 1917 is when Britain pushed the Ottoman Empire up into Turkey. Well, also in 1917 is when Lenin created the autocrat in Russia. So you have the king of the north and the king of the south reappearing.
Okay.
At the same time.
All right, now can I
reintroduce?
It's ironic that 1917 is a revolution in Russia and 1917 that Jerusalem's freed. But can I go a stage further? Because there's another development in the prophecy that we need to just understand. After verse 40, does the words king of the south appear? Okay, so you read those last few verses. Does the king of the south reappear in that prophecy?
No.
Instead, what do we have?
Nations, areas.
No, we have the land of
Egypt.
Egypt. Now that to me is significant. What I think that's saying, Jimmy, is this. Is that Britain in Egypt is the king of the south. It pushed at the Turk, pushed them out. But when Russia invades, there is no foreign power in occupation of Egypt. Otherwise, it would have said, King of the South. But it says the land of Egypt. And that's why when Britain left Egypt, Egypt took control of its own country, and we haven't seen a foreign power in occupation of Egypt. Now, you'll often hear, and it was heard this afternoon, King of the South still exists. Can I just be a bit pedantic about that? Whilst it is true that these Arabian nations, Sheba, Dedan, and all those regions, are south of Israel, they are not technically king of the south. Why? because King of the South is a foreign power in occupation of Egypt. So if you want to be pedantic, it is true there are southern nations there, but the King of the South is gone.
Technically, Russia has both.
Yeah.
North and the South.
Well, no, because this region here, when it takes the land of Egypt.
They're going to take over Egypt, so they'll occupy both.
Yeah, it will have both, but it's not called the King of the South on that. So technically speaking, whilst that Arabian Peninsula is south, it's not really the King of the South. It's just a southern confederacy of nations, okay? Just to be a bit pedantic. This King of the South power has disappeared. Egypt is now in control of its own destiny. It's the land of Egypt. Okay. So when Russia comes down, as Jimmy said before, it comes down the coast, ships come down. Here is Sevastopol, Black Sea Fleet, comes through the Dardanelles. It'll come down through here. There's also a base here, Tarsis, I think it's called. Not the Tarsus of Scripture, that also will have a power through here. So you'll have an invasion by sea, an invasion by land. Egypt's the prize. Out of the east and the north will come tidings, which will cause this power to sweep back up, and Armageddon occurs at that point. Armageddon is the second phase. The first phase is down the coast into Egypt. The second phase is back to Jerusalem for battle. The fact that all nations will be involved in Jerusalem for battle suggests that whilst Russia is here taking Egypt, there is a consolidation of Western powers in Jerusalem. Otherwise, how can you have a battle of all nations unless the Western powers are there? How do the Western powers get there so quickly? It is likely that the bases here in Jordan, Saudi Arabia, would become the forward bases for Western troops to slip across to Jerusalem. Possibility. And that's why we look with interest as to the way in which Jordan continues to be in the Western alliance, with Western bases being established in that region. Okay, any questions?
So even though Russia will be the king of the north, either economically or militarily taking over that area,
yep.
There will still be Western military in that area,
yep.
Is what you're saying?
In Jordan. See, because the point is that this is why this region escapes. There's something across the Jordan which is sufficiently disturbing to bring Russia back, ties to the north and the east, and also allows foreign troops to actually hit Jerusalem. That's why there's a strong possibility that the Western powers will consolidate in Jordan. And whilst it's true, Neil says that providentially that they'll miss Jordan because it's province of God, it also makes sense to have Western bases there ready for the Battle of Armageddon. Jimmy?
I think I'm going to clarify this in my mind, because I've always thought there was three phases. Maybe I'm mistaken.
Go on, yep.
Where you have Russia comes down to Egypt.
Yep.
You have an occupation or a collaboration of those southern power in Jerusalem, where Russia goes up and defeats them, establishes his palaces.
Yep.
Phase two. And phase three is when Christ and the saints...
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. We haven't talked about phase three. Yeah, we just talked about phases one and two.
Okay, you said when they go back up, that's the Battle of Armageddon. Well, it's like there's another phase in between.
Well, yeah. Phase one and two end up at Jerusalem, and then Christ comes to complete the battle.
Okay.
Yep, that's fine. We're on the same page. Yep, Neil.
So the end of verse 4 talks about entering into countries, overflowing, and passing over. That's talking about the king of the north going against the
everything.
And
yeah, him, it'll take Turkey, it'll take Israel, it'll take Egypt. Those are the countries.
So that's happening at the same time that Russia's invading the south?
Well, the way Daniel 11 presents it, like you said, it was a storm, okay? An overflowing, I think Jimmy said, of the glass. So war will happen simultaneously on different fronts. You'll have ships coming down here, that takes Turkey. You'll have troops coming down here, that takes the land forces. So it's not like one, two, it's simultaneous, it's several fronts.
Well, I thought Turkey was one of the, was already a union.
Now, excellent question. Ezekiel 38, Tagama. Where is Tagama? Tagama is more here than here. The Tagama region is the Armenian area. So Turkey will be independent right to the very end until it's invaded by Russia. However, Tagama, which is Armenia, Georgia, Kazakhstan up here will be taken as part of the Ezekiel 38 alliance.
So, Gomer is not Turkey?
Where's Gomer? Gomer is France. French forces will be with Russian forces, Ezekiel 38. Tony.
For Tagarma, I had noted that from Tagarma were descended those who the Greeks called Phrygians.
Yep.
The
Phrygians?
Connection
yep.
between the, what did you call it? What did you say? How do you pronounce it?
Phrygians.
Phrygians and the Armenian is universally accepted,
yep.
Josephus.
Exactly. Tagarma is more the Armenian area than the Turkey area. Another question. Do we have another? Exciting, isn't it? I think it's fascinating stuff. Okay. All right, so the Daniel 11 talk was nearly there. It just needed that third party, the hymn, to complete it. And to get there, we had to go back to Daniel 8 to find Rome in the equation.
I think you said it was
that. Okay. All right. Okay. I've passed my time, but I want to go to Daniel 2, okay? Because Daniel 2 is also significant.
We got all night. We got all night.
Go all night? Okay. That's a worry. Go all night. Now, just out of interest, Russia attempted to take Turkey back in the Crimean War, just out of interest. So that back in the 1850s, here is Crimea, which is, by the way, the Black Sea Fleet. Russia attempted to take Turkey. This was, if you like, a Russian invasion of Turkey. But it couldn't succeed because it wasn't right time. Russia did not have the King of the North territory. And that's why when Britain came in and pushed the Turks back here, you had Britain and Russia at war in the Crimean War. Okay. The famous poem, the Light Horse Brigade, was written during this time. This ridiculous charge of the Light Brigade by the British at the Battle of Balaclava, when all the British went charging into battle and they got slaughtered, every one of them. That's the Battle of Crimea. Yep.
Around what year was this?
This is the 1850s.
1850s.
Now, you can understand, Brother Thomas is writing Elvis Israel in 1848. And he's saying Russia is invading Turkey. Now, what else would you conclude?
Mm-hmm.
That Armageddon's going to happen soon. Now, it didn't happen. But you can see how the prophetic pages, he's thinking along these lines. Russia invading Turkey. Hey, this is Daniel 11. But no, it didn't work that way. Okay. King of the South pushing at him. There's General Allenby. There's Allenby coming to Jerusalem. He didn't fire a shot into Jerusalem. Not a single shot. He got off his horse in deference to the fact that he was a conquering king who didn't feel worthy to actually take the city. So he got off his horse and walked. And these flags here are the Australian and New Zealand flags of the Light Horse Brigade. It's a bigger picture than the British picture. Okay. There's our summary. The countries that make up the King of the North territory. I've added a few extras because when I was researching exactly the territory involved, it was a little bit of Turkey here, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, but it also actually hit Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan. Look, you know, it's that general area. I mean, Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan are all part of the Russian regime anyway at the moment, but you get the picture. Russia must dominate that area first before it can be classified as the King of the North. All right, Daniel 2. We're going to slip through these very, very quickly.
So even though in Daniel 11 he's called the King of the North before he actually takes over that area, it's...
No, he's not called King of the North until he actually takes that area. King of the North is a foreign power in occupation of that territory.
So it says the King of the North shall come against him,
yep.
Like a whirlwind.
So that's a foreign power in occupation of the Seleucid Empire invading Turkey. We know from Ezekiel 38 that foreign power is Rosh.
Okay, so he's the King of the North before he actually takes
Turkey? No, he's a northern king. But he doesn't become King of the North until
okay,
he occupies...
So he's king from the North, not the king
correct,
of the North. Okay,
correct. 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 He's not classified King of the North in Daniel 11 terms until he takes that territory, even though he comes from the North and is a northern king. Yep.
So it's really king from the North would be classified.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
And to clarify also, Ezekiel 38, Gog is the confederacy of all those nations.
Gog is the individual. He's prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal.
So that would be the president?
Yep, Putin.
Okay.
Gog means, anyone know what Gog means? One at the top. That's Putin to my terms at the moment. Great, that's good. Good questions. Good questions. I think we're on the right page. Daniel 2. How do we know Daniel 2 is a latter-day prophecy? Okay, what verse? Let's read verse 28. Let's go to Daniel 2. Our next reader, I think Jimmy, you. Daniel 2, verse 28, please.
But there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Thy dream and thy visions of thy head upon thy bed are these.
Okay. Now, why do I emphasize that? Yeah, okay, answer.
Because the image is standing complete at the time.
Exactly. Whilst it is true that we can present a seminar, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, whilst that's all very nice and wonderful as it is, the principal application of the prophecy is a latter-day prophecy. The focus of changing empires from Babylon to Rome is how we get to the end. Now, normally, and this was the same with the presentation here this afternoon, did a great job, Manny, but there's another dimension to this, that whilst it is true that all these nations followed each other, in the end, we want to know what will stand at the final conclusion, and that's the point of the prophecy, point number one. Okay, the focus is latter days. Manny didn't have this graphics, but it makes a bit of a difference, doesn't it? Okay, there's the Babylonian Empire. Okay, next, Medo-Persian. We know that. And the Medo-Persian is coming. So here's a question. How come this empire is inferior to Babylon? Manny did answer it, but what's the answer to that question? Well, look at the territory, it's much bigger. How can it be inferior?
Reigning authority power.
Yep. Yeah, because the power base is diffused. We've got Medo-Persian, two powers. We've got a distribution of rulership throughout. Nebuchadnezzar was a dictator. He didn't have anybody telling him what to do. So, greater extent, but inferior. The third one. Bear rule over all the earth. But hold on. The Greeks did not bear rule over all the earth. How would you explain that?
Earth related to Israel?
The earth is defined as the then known world, or the civilized world. Okay? Anything outside that boundary was not classified as civilized. It wasn't the earth. The earth is defined as the territory of the kingdom of men.
Is it through their culture?
Yes, I think so. I think we can include the culture there. Yep. Yep. Okay, now, so far so good. Let's come to Rome. And this is where we need to just be a bit clear about this. The Roman Empire only got as far as the Euphrates here, times of Hadrian, AD 117 through here. Okay. So whilst it's linked with Israel, it certainly didn't have any of the empire of the East over here. It's all Western over here. But in Daniel chapter 2, we have some detail. The fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. Deuteronomy 28, nation strong as iron, Rome. Iron breaks in pieces, so it breaks in pieces and bruises. What's that a reference to? Genesis 3 verse 15. Bruising power. The kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron. Now, the power of this is, to an interested friend, is Babylon gets taken by Medo-Persia. Medo-Persia gets taken by Greece. Greece gets taken by Rome, but Rome doesn't get taken by anybody. Now, there were other world empires, but as far as Daniel is concerned, we're interested in the fracturing of this Roman Empire. So it's a different end. It's not being replaced by another empire. It's the fracturing of this existing power. And that's why it remains on the scene. It is not conquered by another world power. It fractures. And it's the fractures that Daniel's interested in looking at. Now, it's mixed with clay. From verse 43, what is the interpretation of the clay?
Not to hear it.
No, just read the verse.
Deceived men.
Right, excellent. The clay is defined as the seed of men. What on earth does that mean? Because whatever it is an exposition of the clay. The iron is strength. The clay is the seed of men. So we really need to understand this term, seed of men. Can we define this in the record? Well, we can. First point. The Roman power would dominate all other existing empires. Now, did that happen? As iron breaketh all these, did the Roman Empire break all the other existing empires?
Not the east.
No, why? Because that map that we saw only went as far as the Euphrates. So in Daniel 2 verse 40, while we say, yep, the Roman power came on the scene, there is embedded in verse 40 still a future application. The Roman power will one day dominate all those other territories. Okay? It shall break in pieces all these. It only broke half of them. Point number one. Secondly, the Roman Empire would be broken up, but would be retaining elements of its own strength. And we'll look at this in a moment. This empire is different. Normally, when another empire comes along, they throw out the old administration. But this empire, when it fractures and dissolves, retains some of its old qualities and characteristics. It's different. Okay? It retains some elements of the iron. And the third point is that the Roman Empire fractures into the seed of the men class. Now, I've got there just this statement here that seed of the men represents democratic influences. How on earth do we arrive at that conclusion? Let's come to Daniel chapter 1. Yeah, a couple of seats over here, guys. Daniel chapter 1. Okay, Tony, could you read for us, please, Daniel chapter 1 and verse 3.
King spake unto Ashpenaz, master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, and of the king's seed, and of the princes.
In Daniel chapter 1, we have this expression called the king's seed. How would you define the king's seed in Daniel 1 verse 3?
His family.
Who was a prince. Daniel was descended from the royal line of David. Therefore, the king's seed is someone who is descended from the royal line of royalty. In absolute contrast, what do you think the seed of men would represent?
Common men.
Commoners. Isn't that interesting? That the seed of men is placed in deliberate contrast to the king's seed, because the seed of men is government by the people, for the people, if you like. Common men. And that's why we have this comment there, that the division of the empire, whilst retaining the strength of the iron, involved external democratic processes. Why do I say they're external processes? Why do I say they came outside into the empire? Because the feet and the toes originally were iron. And to get clay in, you've got to bring clay from outside. So the implication of the prophecy is that when the clay comes, it comes outside the empire, not part of iron, and it's also different to the king's seed. It is the seed of men. Now, what happened in history? All right, sorry, any questions so far? Does that make sense? The seed of men, common man, as opposed to the king's seed. It's an influence that comes outside the empire. It attributes the fracturing of the empire, and it hangs the empire together. Okay? Now, what happened? Well, the demands of prophecy. This empire would not be conquered by another empire, point number one. Point number two, the dissolving, the fracturing of this empire would be through the seed of men. Hence, there had to be 10 external powers representing a different form of rulership compared to Roman rulership that would invade the empire, fracture the empire, but at the same time, it would leave the strength of the empire intact. That is a significant restriction on the prophecy. You think about that. It's totally different from Greeks taking Medo-Persians, Rome taking Greece. This is a demanding prophecy that tells us exactly how this empire is going to fracture. And the demands of the prophecy are, there's an invasion, 10 powers are involved, it's a different form of rulership than Rome, and yet somehow the strength of that iron is retained. Most unusual. When empires change, you throw out the old. Not so with the Romans. Okay. Well, the barbarian powers were the seed of men. And across something like about 250, 300 years, these invasions began to take place. If you want to note those down in your margin, those are the 10 original 10 toes. Write them down, it's good. Huns, Visigoths, Gepidae, Burgundians, Bavarians, Vandals, Lombards, Suevi, Alans, and Franks. Always good to have that list. I'll give you a couple of minutes to do that. They didn't all come at once. They came in waves, and they came across 200, 300 years of the Roman Empire. Fifth one is Bavarians.
Bavarians.
You've heard of Bavarian cake?
Different than Bavarians.
Yep. Nothing to do with Bavarian cake. Anyway, the Bavarians ended up in Germany. Yep. Barbarian is just a Greek concept of anyone who's not a civilized person. Vandals, we get the name of people who copy them, because these people vandalized parts of the Roman Empire. Now, this is a whole class in itself. This is just a summary. But these are the seed of men. The interesting thing about each one of those powers was that it was ruled by common men. Generally, their kings were elected. Their rulers were elected from the body. A different kind of rulership from the emperors in the Roman Empire, who generally bought their spot. All right, everyone got those down? Okay, move on. So, there's a map of the Roman Empire, and that's what it looked like after it had been carved up. Now, what is interesting is that all of this invasion took place on the western part of the Roman Empire. The eastern part here was unaffected by that barbarian invasion. It's the western part of the empire itself. And they just made it a patchwork quilt. the foundations of modern Europe itself. Now, here's a quotation from a book called European Civilization, which I think is very interesting. It was through the German barbarians that the sentiment of personal independence was introduced into European civilization. It was unknown in the Roman world, unknown in the Christian church, and unknown in most civilizations. So you see, the barbarian clay, seed of men element, introduced into the Roman Empire influences that were unknown in the world. It's not iron. It's clay. Personal independence. The sentiment of personal independence, a love of liberty displaying itself at all risks without any other motive but that of satisfying itself. It was the barbarians that brought it in and deposited in the cradle of civilization where it's played so conspicuous a part. So what that's saying is the clay, the seed of men, was a unique form of government, independence, love of liberty. Hey, this is common man, this is democracy, this is different to the iron power of Rome. Isn't that interesting? But the prophecy demands that the strength of the iron remain. Each of the barbarian kings adopted Roman religion, Roman language, and Roman laws into their kingdoms. They were also anxious to receive appointments and legitimacy from the Roman emperor in the east. Even the coins that were minted were stamped with the bust of the emperor of the east rather than the barbarian prince. So here they are retaining the strength of the iron. The strength of the iron is religion, language, and law. And Latin and the legal system and the religion is still part of the European experience today. Combined with democracy, it is a magnificent fulfillment of prophecy. Combined together. Roman elements of religion, law, language, and the element of democracy and independence and freedom and love of liberty combined together. Now, the ability of the populations in the empire to retain their old culture despite the barbarian breakthrough appears most obvious in the matters of religion and language. Only Britain became dominated by Germanic culture and speech. The barbarians in West Europe were eventually absorbed linguistically into local populations. There's an integration between clay and iron. So, the expectation of Daniel 2 is not just the sequential following of empires one after the other. It is the rise of a single latter-day dominion. Proof, there's a Google shot of the world, there's a Google shot of what we expect for Daniel 2. Why do we expect the amalgamation of all of these territories? Because of this little word or little phrase in verse 35. Okay, our next reader, please. So I don't know your name on the end. Behind Manny.
Jason.
Okay, could you read for us, please, Daniel 2 and verse 35. And I want you to underline a little word after we've read this. Thanks.
Daniel 2:35. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together.
Right, you can stop there. Together, underline it. It is a key part of the prophecy. We're not talking about just the dimension of empires following each other. We're talking about the amalgamation of these empires. And it's the Roman power which will do that. It is the strength of the iron that will do that. So the old empires of Persia, Greece, Babylon, and Rome are going to exist in one huge confederacy. That's Ezekiel 38. That is Ezekiel 38. Same time period, latter days. And it is the iron power that breaks these. It is the strength of the Roman system which will get that confederacy together. We're talking about Islam over here. We're talking about Orthodox Christianity over here. We're talking about Catholicism over here. But in the end, this part of this confederacy will be the dominant part of the alliance. So, the Daniel chapter 2 talk was great. It just needed this little extra bit at the end to tell us what shall be in the latter days. It is a focus of a single dominion. Who will rule that single dominion? Ezekiel 38 says Rosh will. And what Rosh will do is it will add this part of the empire as well. It's the amalgamation of all those empires. Jimmy.
It's, you know, sometimes our lectures, even though the pictures we put up don't depict it, but as we're explaining it, the audience is seeing an image, and the head gets lopped off, and the chest and arms are gone, thighs are gone, the legs, and then they see the 10 toes, and then the stone comes and hits the 10 toes.
Yep.
That's kind of how we explain it.
Yep. You have to explain it as together. Right. It's that's why it's a key word. There must exist in the latter days all these empire territories together. And when they exist, then the stone hits it. That's the power of Daniel chapter 2. Yes?
So is it the attributes of them that all stands together, or is it the geographic?
It's the geographics. It's the geographics.
Would you link that together with verse 40, talking about the future application of Rome, breaking in pieces all things?
Yep, that's what I'm saying. Rome,
yeah.
Rome is the dominant power. That verse has only partially been fulfilled because, right, as we saw before, the Roman Empire only took us to here.
Right, okay. So technically that section of that verse would be linked together with the together, yep, which is that.
Yep. The together. Yeah. The iron is the power that does the breaking in pieces and amalgamating it together, definitely. Phew. Let's take a break. We've gone a bit over time. Let's take a break for a quarter of an hour. And then we'll go back to the program. Thank you.